Okay. Hey, Pre-show.
Hey.
Today we have Kara Lowenthal, which I'm so excited. Did I say your last name right?
No, it's Cara, got Cara right.
Lowenthal?
Lowenthal rhymes with Nile.
Lowenthal.
Lowenthal. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you have a podcast that I listen to called Unfuck Your Brain, and I cannot wait for you to finally unfuck it all the way. You know what I mean?
That's
I feel like,
unrealistic. We're not going for perfection. It's too far.
what? Unrealistic, like, I'll always be a little fucked.
Yeah, that's what makes us human. Otherwise, we would all be like weird robots.
I guess. Okay. Well, in the pre-show today, I wanted to talk to you about how to deal with political anxiety because I came into 2021 being like, this is going to be so different. Like, I can't wait. It's going to be way better than last year. And then, everything went down on the 6th. And apparently, we're meant to be preparing ourselves for something also terrible to happen on the 20th. So I was wondering if you have like any advice for people like me who find it hard to think straight during politically tense times.
Yes, of course. Sorry, I'm it's a big topic. I think that one of the things that you have to remember is that the way that the news and social media are operating, they're basically hijacking your brain's natural threat response system in ways that are really unnatural, right? So, like, your brain evolved to be this level of anxious about like something that was physically going to try to eat you, right? But this is more, this is like there's something that's going to eat you 300 miles away and you're getting text updates on it every 5 minutes, right? And that's not, your brain's not designed to work that way. Like right, in the age-old days when you were like a little lizard, you didn't need to know that there was a gecko that was, I guess a gecko is a lizard too, but like you didn't need to know that something that ate lizards was like over in Arizona and might be coming your way in 6 weeks. So, but social media and the news make money off of that, right? It's just an eyeballs game to them. Like the longer the eyeballs stay on the page or stay watching CNN or stay on Facebook, the more money they make. That's it. And so, it's very easy to get sucked into this sort of feeling of like urgency and immediacy. And then to sort of think that if we're not losing our minds all the time, we're somehow being like complacent and don't care. Right. And so I think you have to try to find that balance of like, yes, I'm not saying I'm obviously my coaching is very social justice feminist oriented. I'm not saying like, who cares if there's a coup? Well, like, just don't watch the news ever. But it is not, unless you are personally in charge of deploying the National Guard, you don't need minute by minute updates about what's happening at a protest, right? It's just like, unless you are a pulmonary care expert, you don't need to read every latest scientific article about COVID. You already know, wear a mask, wash your hands, don't go inside with people. Like, you don't need to be inundating yourself with all that information that isn't actually changing your choices and or actions in any way, right? So I think a good rule of thumb to ask yourself is like, number one, to set a goal, to set a like, I'm going to check the news twice a day and set a timer and like stop reading it when the timer goes off, once a day, 3 times a day, whatever it is, just pick. And also, like, when you start to feel you're getting sucked in, you can ask yourself, is any of the information I'm learning going to change my immediate actions? If not, then I don't need to be like obsessing and absorbing this right now.
Sure,
sure.
My parents, I'm living with my parents right now, very COVID vibes, and they always have the news on the TV, and it's always the same shit. I mean, obviously there's a lot going on and there's new stuff happening, but like it's constantly cycling over like hours and hours of the same information that they just change like one word about or the headline, but it's like the same thing.
Yeah, I turned on the news just for like an hour when the whole coup attempt started happening, and social media I use more often, so I'm more used to it, and also I just have like a different relationship with it. I never watch cable news, like, so I and I was just streaming it, And so it's really wild. Like, I really got the experience of feeling it, like, start to plug into that part of my brain and being like, whoa, what is happening? Like, I need to turn this off. I can feel my brain being like, we absolutely must know. What are they about to show in that next cutaway to the same thing? Like, I could, like, feel it happening to me. It was so wild. And yeah, when people have the news on all the time, they, like, don't even realize that that's what's happening, that their system is getting activated that way. But it's really powerful to, like, watch it happen and be like, oh, I got to turn this off. Like, this is... I could lose 6 weeks to this if I, like, let myself go.
For sure.
And I have.
Amy.
Hey, Jack.
I'm gay.
Oh, my God. That is so funny. I'm also gay. I was going to tell you.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
And you're listening to Dating Straight.
Hey, Amy.
Hey, Jack. Hey, Kara.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Thank you so much for coming. I listen to your podcast all the damn time. I found you during quarantine, and it's been so grounding to listen to. So today we're joined by feminist rock star, master certified life coach extraordinaire, Kara Lowenthal. Kara Lowenthal. Fuck.
Just give him the first name. Unfuck Your Brain. Just Kara. It's Kara. Fine. Just forget the rest of it.
I was trying so hard that it just, like, didn't work at all. So before we jump into the episode, please make sure to rate, review, subscribe, go to Patreon. We do all the things. So make sure to check it out.
Absolutely.
So, Kara, yes. You Kara. Are a life coach.
Amazing.
And we need it.
This is great. I feel like I don't even know. All I have to do is show up. You guys are already impressed. I'm ready.
Well, I guess it's because I've already listened to, like, many hours of your podcast.
I just don't know about it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a chicken. Absolutely. I'm, like, all the way in. So we wanted to have you on, especially in January, because we want to set ourselves up for, like, a peaceful and happy 2021, maybe even, like, a productive 2021, wow. Because I don't know about you guys, but I did not do that much in 2020. Relatable? No? Okay.
I did a medium amount, but we have higher hopes for this year. That's all I say. Don't know how it's going to go, but we have high hopes.
Yeah. So I myself set some impossible goals, which I tried to explain what impossible goals were, but could you let us know? Because I can't explain it right.
It's like, you know, I joined this cult from a podcast that I heard, and now I have to do this thing.
Yes.
We may have to find a different word than chickens also, because Facebook keeps, I have The Clutch, which is my feminist coaching community. And so people are constantly posting, like, hey, chickens, blah, blah, blah. Like, here's my coaching I need help on. And then Facebook has started flagging those as, like, and deleting them for being, like, harassment and bullying.
What? What does that mean?
I guess because the term chicken, like, you might be calling someone chicken, it's like calling them a coward. I know. I'm like, meanwhile, there's, like, fascist insanity on the app 24/7. And they're like, oh, this, like, ladies' Facebook group of chickens, that's, we gotta crack down on that bullshit. It's really wild. We were like, could not figure out what was going on for a while. And so now it's all like, my fine feathered friends, which hopefully they're not going to crack down on. So an impossible goal is what it sounds like, right? It is the idea of setting a goal that you currently think is impossible to get to. And I think that that sounds counterintuitive to people. Like, why would you try to do something impossible, right? And the idea is really that we are, most of us, I think, dramatically underestimate what we're capable of, especially over the long term. Humans in general have a cognitive bias where we overestimate what we're capable of in a short period of time. So we've all had that, like, insane to-do list. I mean, like, I'm gonna get this all done today. And, you know, we're like, here's what I'm gonna get done this weekend. And then it's like, you do one of those things. So we're not very good with understanding, like, what we're capable of over long periods of time or short periods of time, really. So, but then we underestimate what we can get done in a long period of time because our brains just kind of can't really think past, like, a few weeks. So when you set an impossible goal, you are sort of stretching your brain and yourself to come up with something beyond what you think would be sort of easy or normal to accomplish. And in order to do something that you think is impossible, it will bring up all of your own thought patterns, like all of the things that are kind of constraining you and holding you back in life and making you think that you are not good enough or capable enough or talented enough or don't have enough resources or whatever it is. And so really the journey with an impossible goal, it doesn't even, you know, usually we set a goal and we're like, I want to make it achievable so I can make sure I get there so that I don't have to feel bad about myself if I don't, which is like not a great way of setting goals because you're already sort of like limiting it to just what feels basically safe. Mm-hmm. And then your whole motivation is to avoid being mean to yourself if you fail. Whereas when you set an impossible goal, it doesn't even matter if you get there or not, because the real question is like, who are you going to have to, how are you going to have to change and evolve to get to that impossible goal? If you've only, you know, if you have a business and you've only ever made $50,000 a year in your business, how would all of your thinking and, you know, feeling and acting have to change to make $100,000 in your business or $200,000, whatever it is? It doesn't have to be money. It can be anything. If you've never run a mile, who would you have to become to run a marathon? Right? It almost doesn't even matter if you ever get to the marathon or not, or you make the 200K. What matters is your evolution in trying to become a different kind of person who can do this new thing.
Cool.
Wow. That seems, so, yeah. No, it is. It's a very, I feel like, unique take. At least I feel like sort of what you've been saying, like in my past, every time I've set goals, I've tried to make goals that are doable, because if I don't get there, then I'm like, or I feel like if they're too big, then I'll just like almost forget about them, you know what I mean? Because like, right, I'm not making any progress.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the reasons, it's funny you brought up this topic, because the idea of an impossible goal in general is something that I learned from my teacher and a lot of coaches teach, and I usually don't teach it. I've had the podcast for like 4 years now. This is the first time I've ever taught on the podcast, because I attract a lot of people who are perfectionists, and which means that they are constantly having big, perfect ideas of how they're going to like change everything and do everything differently. And then just like you're saying, it's just like hypothetical. It's not even, you know, they like already sort of know, right, that they're never going to do it. And they don't really make a concrete plan to do it. Or if they do, if they screw it up even once, if they're trying to run the marathon and they like miss one run, then it's like all over. They fall off the wagon. Yeah. So I actually usually teach this tool like only once people have already worked through all of that perfectionism, because a lot of us set goals to either feel better about ourselves, which won't work because you can't like get yourself there by feeling bad about yourself, right? Or because we think our life will be better when we accomplish the goal, which is also not how life works. So it's actually kind of a high level tool. You have to be ready for it to really use it correctly.
Thank you so much, Evelyn, for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. We love Evelyn. Evelyn is comfy, it's cozy, it's cute. Building your wardrobe is a continuous journey of finding what makes you feel the most you. This year, discover fresh favorites that do more than fit your style and shape. Evelyn's Everyday Essential fit your resolution and help make a difference in the world.
Yes. As you can see by my little modeling that I was just doing earlier, I am wearing my Everlane sweatshirt right now. It's lovely. I wear it all the time. It's cute. It's like my uniform. I wear it around my house. I wear it outside. And it just is like good quality. Nothing's like fraying. And
the quality is so good.
And it's nice and soft. I just love it, truly. And I'm sure they have something that you will love too. Get a solid start on the year with dependable everyday essentials like this from Damn Good Denim. True, by the way. Just super soft loungewear. Also true. Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
And yeah, you shop pieces from accessories, comfy base layers, lightweight athletic wear, active wear, and more. Simple designs that complement your wardrobe, premium quality with a transparent, more affordable price. And Everlane partners with the best and most ethical factories in the world, so you can feel good about your fit. So go ahead and get some.
Yeah, you better. So go to Everlane.com/dating and sign up for 10% off your first order, plus free shipping. It's easy returns, 60 days from your ship date, which is long. That's 10% off your first order when you go to Everlane.com/dating and sign up. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much, Everlane. We stan you.
Yes, we do.
And you know what else we stan?
What?
best fiends.
That is also true. Let me tell you something a little bit about best fiends. As we know, it is the only game to me, for me.
The only game.
It is an amazing puzzle game. Sometimes I just found myself, like, you know, forgetting the state of the world and just, like, doing my little puzzles and, you know, just, like, minding my own business and vibing with best fiends up until 3 a.m. it is a great way to pass the time. And it also is really, like, it starts off easy, kind of tricks you, but then eventually you start being like, oh, Miss Best Fiends here actually has a point, and it's making you smarter, making you more creative, and is a lovely puzzle game. The only puzzle game, as I've said.
It's true. When Best Fiends says the fun never ends, that's not an exaggeration. True. There are 5,000 levels and counting. So if you'd worried about getting to level 3,000, don't worry, because there's so many levels. There's always another update. There's always more levels, fun changes to the game based on fan feedback. Just don't blame us if you end up getting obsessed. So download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thanks, Best Fiends. How do you, because I mean, I think I might struggle with perfectionism. Like, how do you get through that? What are some tools that you could offer someone like me?
It's so soothing watching you pet your cat.
They can't see it in the camera, so.
Yeah, she's got her. That's a literal cat. There's a literal feline in her lap that she is petting. It's very soothing. I'm like a little bit like in a little like, I feel like I'm being like she's petted like, into a sleepy state just watching this. My cat.
She's like drooling all over me. Also.
She's like extremely happy. She is fine with 2021. She's like, this is.
Oh, yeah.
Cats are such a good reminder, though, of like how it's your human mind that creates your suffering. You know, like my cat is totally chill. He does not care what's happening. He's not worried about the news. He's fine. How do you deal with perfectionism? I think that's a big project, right? A lot of the work that a lot of when I work with people, that's what we're working on. I think that the whole reason that we're perfectionists is that we don't have self-acceptance the way that we are, right? So we think that we have to be different in order to be good enough. And so I think that's where you always have to start, is by working on that kind of self-acceptance, self-love piece, which is very concrete. Like, it's not, you can't just be like, okay, I've decided to love myself today. Like, you don't know how, or you would have done that already, right?
Totally.
And,
yes.
Which is how a lot of people teach it. And so you have to really learn, you know, what I call it thought work. People call it different things, but it's like the process of identifying exactly what you think about yourself and then working over time to shift those thoughts little bit by little bit, right? And so, and I think with perfectionism especially, it comes from the idea that you're not inherently worthy or good enough as you are, right? You need to be different to be good enough. And so I think I like to just, brains are crazy illogical. So I like to really, like, one of my, I think, most powerful coaching tools and techniques is just to, like, play around with your ideas. You know, we hold our ideas so firmly. We're, like, very attached to them. And just sort of, like, playing around with whether they even make sense. Like, who decides? Like, when does your worth become conditional? Everybody thinks that newly born baby is unconditionally worthy. So is it like at 1 year old, at 2 years old, at 5 years old? I play this game with people all the time, and it's wild. Everybody has a different age, and it's very specific. Like, one person will be like 9 years old. That's when your worth becomes conditional. And then one person will be like 18. Yeah. And then I had somebody say 6 months in utero because she had absorbed a twin in utero, and she had been like subconsciously thinking about that since then. Yeah, like everybody has different brains are crazy, right? So you have to really like dig in there and be like, what do you know, like, does my belief system make any sense? Like, does it make sense that people can be worthy and then they become not worthy, but then you become worthy again? Or like, who decides, right? Who's in charge? Like, if you grow up in the woods and you didn't know any humans, are you worthy? Like, you playing around with those ideas and really getting curious about your own beliefs is one of the best ways to start to shake them up a little bit.
Yeah. That's one of the things that I always love to say. I mean, I don't know if this is exactly what you mean, but it's sort of kind of similar, I feel like. Maybe this is a reach, but like, my favorite thing is to be like, I know nothing. Like, to believe that I truly, truly know anything, mm-hmm. even about myself, is like a fool's game, because like mm-hmm. then I'm just trying to convince myself that I like have something and I rely on that. But like in reality, no, in my head.
Yeah, it's all made up and it's yeah. all subject to change, right? I think like living in it, you know, there's a balance of like knowing it's all, it's sort of like your life is like very serious and not serious at all. It's yes. all made up. Who cares?
Yes.
But also we're yeah. here. So we're going to do something with our time. So we might as well try to accomplish something or to grow or to evolve. Right. But ultimately, yeah, you know, I'm constantly like, you don't get into heaven faster if you do X, Y, Z, right? Like it's not, you're not getting a certified letter from the universe that you're finally good enough. Like you're just going to have to decide. Right. Even though it's all made up and there's no such thing as inherent, you know, worth. I just think like, I like to be like, listen, obviously inherent human worth is a made up concept, but I think either we all have it or none of us has it. Like, it doesn't make any sense to be like, well, everybody has it except me. Like, that can't yeah. be how the system works, yeah, right? No. Especially
yeah,
like, or like, and then like every single person I've ever worked with thinks they're the one. I'm like, this is a big coincidence that everybody else in the world is inherently worthy, but like, all the people who aren't managed end up in my coaching membership. So it's all made up, but that's why I'm very like, I'm very pragmatic. Like, let's figure out what result you get from thinking a thought in your life. When you think I'm not good enough or I have to prove I'm worthy, how do you feel? How do you act? Like, you end up running around like a lunatic trying to convince everyone else that you're good enough and never feeling good enough. If you decide to practice believing that you are good enough, what kind of feelings and actions and results are we going to get then? Your life is going to look very different.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Mm-hmm. What are like some physical ways that we can put that into practice? Like to put into practice that I believe that I'm good enough and that I like love myself unconditionally.
Like, you got to start much. Through, like... I always say like it shouldn't seem inspirational at all. Like it should not, okay. it would like not go on a Pinterest quote. It would not look good on a pillow. It should be, it's like, like it's possible that my brain is wrong, that I'm the worst person alive. Like that's a good like starting uh-huh. point. It's yeah. possible. Yeah.
So you just like meditate on that?
Yeah, you literally practice the thought, right? So your unconscious mind is thinking, estimates are all over the place. They've done different studies. Human consciousness is a mystery. Nobody totally understands it. But like, One mainstream estimate you see a lot is that you're having 60,000 thoughts a day. Oh, you're not man. Conscious of oh. most of them. Yeah, it's a lot.
A lot.
If you ever feel overwhelmed in your brain, that's why. Uh-huh. A lot of it's running automatically. It's just like, that's a table. That's a chair. My leg goes here. This is a door. Like, you know, it's yeah. not all, it's not all genius in there. A lot of it is just sure. like the daily, daily operations keeping you moving through the world. But you've been like, if you are, you know, in your 20s, in your 30s, 40s, however old you are, you have spent at least 15 years unconsciously practicing. And that's if you're 20, let's say, unconsciously practicing all of these thoughts you have about yourself, right? So you have to consciously practice new ones. I mean, I think part of the big problem with like positive thinking or thought, like the way people think about mindset or thinking new things, is they think they're just supposed to like say the thought once and then they magically believe it. But like, you don't walk into the gym and be like, well, I've never done anything here, but I think I'd like to deadlift 500 pounds. And then like that goes super well for you, right? Or like, I haven't practiced at all. I think I'll run this marathon. That's not how things work. Your brain is not literally a muscle, but it works like a muscle in the sense of repetition is what, right? The neuron, that saying of the neurons that fire together, wire together. It means that like, your brain actually creates habitual patterns, right? Literally like the electrical signals get stronger the more that you use them. I think the amazing gift is that if you've thought that you're unworthy for 20 years, you don't have to practice thinking you're worthy for 20 years to catch up. Like it's not a one-to-one time equivalent, but you do have mm-hmm. to practice. It's not just like, well, I say it once to myself. So yeah, I mean, literally saying it out loud to yourself. You can also, some studies show that people learn things much more quickly by singing them, which makes sense if you think about like the tradition oral, before written writing, that's how information was passed down for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years for millennia, not just that, for millennia was like singing. So I definitely have clients who make up little songs with their thoughts that they're trying to practice and believe.
Cute.
Some studies show it's up to like 20 times faster to learn that way.
Whoa.
Wow.
You can write them on a post-it note, make them your password. But yeah, it's literally just thinking it as much as possible. Wow. And then eventually that circuit has now fired more often and the other one has fired less because you've been like redirecting your brain. And then over time, the new circuit becomes the dominant thought, and then it moves into your unconscious. Just like learning a new skill, at first you have to really pay attention when you do it, and then it moves into your unconscious, and your brain can carry it out while you do other things.
Thank you so much, Usual Wines, for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. Usual Wines are wines for the modern drinker. Each bottle is 6.3 ounces, which is a heavy pour or about a glass and a half of wine. So there's going to be no more pouring wine down the sink if you don't want to finish the bottle. Because of the single serve format and bottle design, Usual is always fresh. So there's going to be no more stale, bubbly, flat rosé. The opposite of those, actually. The wines are low carb and have 0 grams of sugar. Usual has a red blend, a rosé, a sparkling white wine called Brut. They also have Usual Spritz, a low alcohol, 8.5%, low calorie wine spritzer that's made of sparkling wine and guava juice.
Oh my God,
it's like a White Claw for grown-ups. And it's only 83 calories per serving.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about Usual Wines. They did not ask for my personal endorsement, but I'm going to give it. I loved it. It was so good. Like they said, the pours, the like serving sizes are just perfect. You get a little extra. And it was really yummy. They come from like world-class areas where the grapes are grown, like Sonoma and Santa Barbara and Napa and all of those places that like mean something in wine. And they did mean something. They were really good. So go check out their website at www.usualwines.com and use our discount code DATING for $8 off your first order and try your first glass on us.
Thanks, Usual Wines. That's awesome. I must try that. The way that I found your podcast is because I realized that, like, I have really poor body image. Is that, like, the right way to say that?
Yeah.
So I think I literally searched, like, body image on the podcast app, and that's how I found your podcast. And that is so, like, I was so conditioned to believe that to be a certain weight meant that I would be successful. So I think that through thought work, I mean, I would love to undo that.
Yeah.
Because that is such a useless thought, honestly. Like,
yeah,
it's not
it also doesn't even make any sense. Like, unless your profession is being a fashion model, who gives a fuck, right? I mean, it's totally irrational. But yeah, that's what we're taught. I mean, everybody, but especially women in our society, are taught that love and acceptance and success depend on what you look like and particularly how much you weigh. So it's super common. But yes, you can recondition your brain. I mean, I used to think that I couldn't be a coach because this is before I had done that reconditioning work. Like, who would hire a fat life coach? Obviously, they don't know anything and can't get their own life together, right? And now, of course, like having the body I have and being in the public eye and being a coach is the most powerful thing about my coaching, right? It like draws in people who look like me and people who are more conventionally sized or conventionally attractive who are like, wait, I feel like shit about myself, but she's confident. Like, I got to find out what's going on here. Like, I have to figure, what is the secret sauce? So I think like the thing that often what I find is that the thing that we think is the worst thing about us or the thing that's going to hold us back is often actually our greatest asset. We just have to understand how to look at it differently.
Wow. Shit. Yeah. honestly, everything you're saying, I'm like, damn, like that is wonderful. Yeah, why is it that it's like mostly women who get so caught up in body image? It's just like how society has trained us. And why did society do that?
Why did society do that? I too would like to have a word with society about its bullshit. I think body weight and size, first of all, obviously this like can depend based on cultural context and where you are, but there's a lot of factors. But in general, this is a big, I don't want any like anthropologists screaming in my DMs. This is a big generalization, but just as a way to understand things. Historically, when food was scarce in many societies, right? Before we had modern agriculture and the Industrial Revolution, it was like people spent most of their time trying to like get enough food to live, right? Being larger was actually a social status symbol, right? So it was harder to be larger because that meant that was a sign that you had enough food, you had more than enough food, you didn't have to probably do any manual labor, right? So that was like a sign of wealth and class. Humans are usually quite hierarchical societies. And so there's always, you know, there's always this sort of, there's often this sort of class division. And so historically being bigger was a sign of wealth and superior class. And then we get modern agriculture, we get the Industrial Revolution. All of a sudden there's quite a lot of cheap, plentiful food in some places in the world, obviously not everywhere, but in America and in most Western countries. Even though there is still obviously a social hunger problem because we don't have the correct distribution networks. Mm-hmm. So it became easier to be larger and it became harder to be thinner because the food is modified. A lot of it is processed. People aren't as physically active because of the change in work and because of the Industrial Revolution and now the technological revolution. There's pollution. There's endocrinological changes from pollution. Like there's a lot of factors, but basically it's just completely flipped 180 degrees. Now it takes money, time, and effort to stay thin and to look thin. And so that has more social status. There's also in America specifically, like a fucked up but fascinating association between diet culture and thinness and slavery. So in like the 1830s and 40s, women's magazines in the United States started, and this work is, I always blank on her name, but I actually like should Google it because I want to give her credit. it's important to do that. I will tell the story while I'm looking for the name. But there's basically women's here we go. Her name is Sabrina Strings. She wrote this book, Fearing the Black Body, The Racial Origins of Fat Phobia, which is a fantastic book. It's basically, she talks about how in the 1830s and 40s, women's magazines in the United States started publishing articles saying that white women should try to be thin and restrain their eating and have a slim figure because that was more moral and godly and civilized as compared to Whoa. Black and enslaved women who were, you know, lazy and fat and gluttonous. So it's like this very, very explicitly articulated kind of white Wow. supremacy that created the obsession with diet culture and thinness and that association with like class and morality in the United States.
Personally, I feel like sort of on the opposite spectrum, like I am a really thin man, gay man, and like that is, I feel like so not wanted in the community, and mm-hmm. I wonder why that is too. There's got to be something also just as deep that I need to explore.
Yeah, well, I think like it's, you know, there are, the studies will show that certainly there's a higher incidence of eating disorders among gay men compared to straight men, and I think it's the same. There's all lots of deep theory, right? But it's the similarity is that both gay men and straight women are kind of socialized or conditioned to believe that they need to be sort of attractive to the male gaze is the mm-hmm. kind of defining thing about what makes them attractive or worthy or good enough. And so anytime you are making sort of your physical appearance should be X way, and that's the determining factor of if you're going to find love and happiness, people are going to feel alienated from their bodies, develop eating disorders, have poor body image, right? Like in any population, that's what you're going to end up with.
Mm-hmm. So then I guess my question is, like, because I also am a part of the male gaze, like how do we deconstruct that from within, like as someone who contributes to that problem? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, and women contribute to it too, right? Like women police other women's bodies and women cooperate with. I mean, we're all, mm-hmm. patriarchy is bad for everybody, right? It's not like sort of men are bad and then the poor, it's like we're all, it's just, it's not about individuals in the sense that like it's a structural problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think number one, like, I think it depends, your positioning depends. Like if you were, like, what are the things that straight men could do? Like condition themselves to be sexually attracted to a broader range of body types. I actually think that's true for gay men or lesbians or anyone. Like, we can all work on kind of deconditioning the idea that only certain bodies are attractive, mm-hmm. right? And then I think there's this whole other level in dating that goes on where there are like any person who is like, I'm sure you've experienced this, like any, like a thin man, a fat woman, whatever, anybody who's outside the norm can tell you there's plenty of people who are sexually attracted to people who look like you, right? Yeah. Like, there are plenty of straight men who want to have sex with fat women. But there's a social stigma to dating people who are outside the like boundaries of what's considered conventionally attractive in your community, right? And so I think one of the biggest things that any of us can do is use, and this is like true in any different sector of oppression, right, is use whatever social or power or privilege you have to destigmatize people who are, you know, the sort of experience of or intimacy with people who are in a different marginalized identity. So I think, like, we can, and we all have it internalized too, right? Like, mm-hmm. I also have been conditioned to think that, like, thinness is more attractive than fatness. And I will say, like, when I did my body image work on myself, I changed my view of women's bodies. And then I went back into dating and I was like, oh shit, I got to do this all over again for men's bodies. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, so I'm straight and I'm dating men. Like, I had to decondition not just my view of my own body, but like, what are my thoughts about the body? What am I attracted to? Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is social and can be undone. Not your orientation, right? Like, I'm not, but like, you're, just to be clear, that's not what I'm saying.
Don't worry. I didn't think
you're
so.
Just trying to be careful, right? Whenever you talk about thoughts having any impact on sexual attraction, there's somebody who thinks, like, you're saying you can just think yourself straight or think yourself gay. I don't mean your orientation, right?
I'll give it a shot, but I bet it won't work.
Yeah, not that. But in terms of what we are attracted to is very socially, right? Just like, mm-hmm. in the past, it would be like plumpness would be more desirable. And now it's the right, that kind of stuff has to do with like how we're raised, what we're shown, what bodies we see in advertisements, what bodies we see getting rewarded for being beautiful or attractive. And so some of that we can recondition in ourselves. And I think that's something that all of us can do and that benefits us, benefits the people that we're intimate with, and adds up for the bigger society.
For wow. sure. I will say, for you,
if you have anybody who's got their own body image stuff, one of the biggest things I recommend in addition to thought work is just changing up your visual diet, right? So like, go through your Instagram, go through whatever. You need to be looking at bodies that are the same as yours or have a yep. more pronounced version of the thing you're insecure about. You literally have to change what your eye, like, we think that our eyes are just cameras that like record and report to our brain. They're not. What you believe literally impacts what you see, like what you will think your visual cortex is telling you. And so you can reprogram that both through active thought work, but also through just changing what you see, because your brain has something called a familiarity bias, where the things that it sees the most often are what it thinks are normal or to be prized, right? Or are more attractive.
Wow. Yes. Yeah. I've purged wow. like 95% of the Insta gays I follow, and I have never
yeah exactly I totally did that in the beginning, and like, now it's so wild. I used to look at a advertisement with a traditionally sized model, so that's gonna be somebody's like a zero or a two, size two or something, and be like, that's, you know, thought that was beautiful and that's what I should look like. And I'm not saying that's not beautiful, but for my own good, I have retrained my brain to not see that way. And now when I see a plus size model, I'm like, that's the normal beautiful thing. And when I see a straight size model, I'm actually like, wait, what? Like, that's mm-hmm. that looks weird. I'm not saying that people right. obviously that small thin people actually look weird, but if you have to, whatever body you have to live in or you get to live in, you want to rewire your brain so that seems like the most beautiful, normal body. There's no advantage wow. to thinking some different body is better.
That's so true. I remember in high school, when I first got Instagram, I followed like all of the Victoria's Secret models, and right. I'm never going to be 6 feet tall, 100
right,
pounds.
Right.
So I don't know why I was like, almost, I guess, like punishing myself
we
for
think it's
not
inspirational
looking like
because
that.
This is the lie of diet culture, right? Mm. Diet culture, literally, it's so crazy. At my coach training, when I first got certified, there was this woman there and she's getting coached on weight loss. And this is what she kept saying over, she couldn't even hear herself. This is what she kept saying. When I lose the 25 pounds, I'm going to feel better. I'm going to look better. I'm going to be younger. No. It was like, no, you won't be younger, right? You can't go back in time. And it's like funny, but it's a true, it's like, that's how powerful that association yeah. is, right? That sort of, we think that diet culture sells us this myth that like, yeah, somehow if we just like eat the right way and do the right exercises, we will all look completely different. right? If you look at a like a bunch of dogs in the dog park, you're not like, well, that Chihuahua could be a Great Dane if it just like bulked up at the gym. It doesn't make any sense, right? Yeah. But that's what we're taught. We are taught that there's this like perfect body that's somehow obtainable to all of us and looks the same. So of course you're going to follow Victoria's Secret models. That's going to inspire you to grow 10 inches and have a different hair color and like, right? Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. But that's the lie of diet culture. It's a total fantasy. That's why perfectionists are so often, perfectionism and diet culture go together.
Wow. Diet culture makes no goddamn sense.
No, it makes no sense.
Yeah. I remember in high school, like all of, I'm shocked, like Kardashian selling skinny laxative tea,
which feels
so illegal. Feels illegal.
It should be. It's crazy. It's crazy that we're like, hey, do you not like your body? If you try to actually like empty your intestines more than they naturally should be, then you can love yourself. This is what? Like that, right? I feel like when people look back, they're just going to be like, I mean, this is also potentially controversial, but like, you know, I think beauty culture in general, like, why are we shooting our faces full of poison so that we can't move our eyebrows? Like, what? That's like just completely normal, right? Like, diet culture and ageism, like, it's all related. This sort of incessant kind of inability to cope with the natural progression of time and aging and to try to always look young and look the same as everyone else. I think this is on my mind also. I did an episode this week on my podcast all about this sort of like desire for conformity and how anything great in your life is produced by being different, not by conforming. We just have this, you know, but we are trained that we should like all look the same, all look the certain way, never get old, never be wrinkled, never have hair, never smell weird, never have a human body.
Yeah. Why are we so afraid of being human? That's,
I mean,
me
I
too.
Think
why am I so afraid?
Shit, right? I think that's like fear of mortality. Like, I think a lot of human civilization and culture are structures built up to try to like forget that we're animals.
Yeah.
Right. To like distinguish us from the animals. I think that's part of it.
Whoa. So you're saying that people get Botox because they're afraid of dying? Is that
not? I don't think that's their thought. I don't think they're like, well, if I get Botox, maybe I can live forever. No, but I do think the like obsession with you. I mean, it's particularly cultural, right? There are cultures where being older is respected and revered, and like, right? I mean, it's not always the same. In America, it's very connected to capitalism and to like American exceptionalism and our kind of stories about ourselves as like a young country that's always on the cutting edge. Like, you know, there's like a lot of cultural forces that go into it, but I do think that like a lot, when you look at like philosophy and religion and, you know, a lot of it is like humans trying to be like, are we animals? Are humans different than animals? Do we have dominion over the animals? Like what makes us human? What makes us like, right? I mean, it's like a lot of anxiety around being a human, being an animal and like the ultimate mortality. I do think this sort of like, if I can just preserve my youth, I don't have to make peace with the passage of time.
Yeah. And also I think, like you said, kind of like getting Botox, you don't want to let everyone else in on the fact that you look like you're dying in a way. Like you want everyone to think that you're like but really that's like what you're trying to get rid of is like your wrinkles, which just shows that you're closer to death than, you know, someone without them.
Yeah, and that you're like a human. Like, yeah, I mean, I don't know if you guys saw that show that was just on HBO. What was it called? It had Nicole Kidman and Hugh...
The Undoing?
The Undoing. Nicole Kidman
so
and
Hugh, good.
What is, Hugh Grant. I'm not great at pop culture, but I watched that show. And it was insane. Hugh Grant is 5 years older than Nicole Kidman. Mm-hmm. And in the movie, he looks like a normal 60-year-old man who hasn't had cosmetic surgery done. And she looks like they scraped her face off with a planer. Like, she's had so much work done, so her skin is completely smooth. She can't really move her face. She can't really make normal expressions. And it was so striking just to have her next to him. I think he's more natural than a lot of men in Hollywood. Like he's had, you know, but it's like our pictures of what it looks like to age are completely bananas and like don't match reality. And then everybody feels terrible about themselves for having a normal aging human body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I actually heard something, I don't remember what, but about Botox and how it actually makes you look older than what you are, because youthful people can like move their face and have like very expressive faces.
Yes,
and
then it looks
Botox
odd
can kind of age you in that sense.
But I think we also have to embrace aging, right? I mean, it's particularly hard for women because women are taught that their value is their youth, their fertility, and their sex appeal, and that those things are things that are the province of young people, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I think a lot of women describe this experience of feeling like as they become older, they become, quote unquote, like invisible because they are not getting the same kind of attention. And like that is all a product of socialization, that we have socialized women to think that like feeling alive and visible means getting sexual, you know, attention from men, wanted or unwanted. Like I'm, you know, walking down the street, I don't know why I would want to be not invisible, right? And but I think that's, you know, I mean, I think about this a lot as somebody who has a not, you know, who has a larger body. Like, yes, on the one hand, there's downsides to living in a fat phobic society like this. On the other hand, I feel so grateful that like I have already had to do this work just to be happy. Like, I don't fear aging. I don't fear the loss of my, you know, sort of like pretty privilege. Like, I don't have my self-esteem based on that because I had to do the work to base it on other things. And I think, you know, it's easy to envy people who look a certain way and are conventionally beautiful, but age comes for us all. That starts to change, right? And you often see those people having like real kind of crises. And those are the people who sometimes are go overboard on the surgery or whatever else, trying to like hold on to that identity because that's what they base their self-worth on.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then also that's kind of like, for in the case of Nicole Kidman, like that's probably like how she thinks she's going to get jobs, like how she's going to book
Hollywood jobs. Yeah, and it's
Hollywood
a professional
jobs.
Problem. Totally. Yeah. Yeah, and I don't blame her. I'm not like she's bad. Yeah, she's stuck in this whole problem like the rest of us, right?
She's just
and
like
in
an
her
example.
Industry, that's, yeah, in her industry, that's the norm. But yeah. I do just think it's kind of fascinating how normalized it is now to, I mean, humans have always been kind of obsessed with doing things to their body, right? I mean, there's like lots of cultures have body modification as part of their culture in different ways, mm-hmm. different rites of passage. But I do think this particular version where it's all aimed at like often a lot of body modification in a lot of cultures is like you're supposed to see it, right? It like shows that you've like gone through some rite of passage or you've reached some certain point in your life or you're part of a certain tribe or group or like, you know, it's like supposed to be ornamental and obvious. Mm-hmm. And then we have this kind where we're just trying to like pretend that we just unnaturally never aged past 26.
Yeah. It's got to also be, well, it's not got to. I'm just... theorizing, but it's, I'm thinking like it's, I wonder if it's something about also like women and purity and also like Christian purity of like not tainting your body with tattoos and not, you know, like all of that and remaining just like innocent and pure. I don't know. Kind of
I do think a
scary.
Lot of it is, yeah. I mean, I think the Christianity, the where I see the Christian stuff coming in is this sort of, is that rejection of the animalness of the body, right? I mean, Christian mm-hmm. theology totally. Is a lot about that sort of purity of the spirit and sin of the body. Mm-hmm. I just did an interview this morning with this company called Lemonada Media, and we were talking about sex and kink and whatever, and they were asking, like, how did you, you know, what was your kind of education growing up like, and how do you think that impacted your kind of comfort with sex? And I really do think being raised Jewish is, like, a big part of it for me. Like, it was just not, you know, the Jewish cultural view of sex is not the same as the Christian cultural view of sex. Like, mm-hmm. that the whole idea that sex is sinful and something to be avoided and that, like, the highest, like the closest to God are the people who are celibate and are priests and nuns. You're like, we don't have any of that.
Right.
That's not a thing. Mm-hmm. Like having, you know, I mean, if you're religious, you are supposed to only have sex in marriage. I'm not saying it's not a perfectly sex positive culture everywhere, but like having, like once you're married, at least having sex is a mitzvah, is a good deed. There's a mitzvah, a good deed that a man is supposed to pleasure his wife. Like there's all of this, like much more, I think, connected to the sex and sexuality, which is our, you know, physical, more animal side. And Christianity is kind of very like, tuck it all away, hide all the animal. Like, don't, you know,
yeah.
Don't look at any of that. Like, that's wrong. You know, the sort of like, people have dominion over animals. Animals are base.
Yeah.
And then there's all that gender, right? Men are the mind, women are the body. Like, all of that is Christian theology also.
And that's got to be where, like, shaving culture for women comes from, too, is to, like, not be, like, an animal. Because men,
right,
I think...
like, you should...
Because men, I think we kind of are allowed to be more... Like, we're kind of, like, seen as, like, ferocious or, like, able to go out and provide, you know? Like, that's kind of the animal that we think of, I think, as well.
Yeah, I think that's, like, very specifically the sort of white Christian, you know, women are pure kind of, yeah, rhetoric.
Crazy. Totally. Everything is so deep. Much to think about.
Is this what you guys thought this podcast interview was going to be like?
Kind of, yes.
Kind of, yeah.
I'm just like sneaking deep philosophy into the life coaching industry just from the side.
And I'm obsessed. And I'm glad that you're doing that.
Yeah. We're all just stunned into silence. We're like, well, yeah, like,
I need
now. This part, now we got to go back to Aristotle, and this podcast is over.
I did want to ask you. This is something, another sort of like personal problem, but I'm sure that a lot of people are going through this because it is kind of a global pandemic, after all. So I just graduated college. And I like moved home with my parents reasonably. I haven't reached all of the, you know, goals that I would have liked to coming out of college or fantasized about. You know, don't have a job. I mean, we make some money through this podcast, but not enough to like survive right now. Only gotten like one job interview after like 50 applications or so. So I wanted to know, like, how do you feel like people like me, should work to feel successful while sort of being disappointed in like our current world and the current capitalistic structure? And that's a big question, but
how do we make peace with the decline of democracy and late stage capitalism?
Yeah. And is there ethical consumption? No, I'm kidding.
I mean, I'm, like I said, I'm very pragmatic. I'm like, listen, I don't think the revolution's coming in my lifetime. So we're going to have to like figure out how to live in the current world that we have. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go back to like really the life coach hat here, which is I think a lot of people are obviously struggling with this. And you see, even if you like look at the memes, there's sort of like the war of memes, one of which is like, of course you couldn't get anything done and you're sleeping all the time and whatever. It's a pandemic. Just be nice to yourself. And then the other one, which is like, you know, you can get do anything anytime and like work hard, whatever, right?
Who do I believe?
But I think it's a false duality, right? And the answer is actually like and, not or. Because I think that the reason that people ricochet is that they have goals for themselves. Maybe they don't meet them. Maybe life turns out differently, right? And then they think the only options are, it's like either I have to believe I could have done more and then I have to blame and be mean to myself, right? Or I have to go this extreme other route, which is being so compassionate and empathetic for myself that I just like give up on accomplishing anything. And just, right? And I think it's like a false dichotomy, right? I think that the answer to like where you are is to do both, is to take what I call massive action, which is like if you do want a job that enables you to move out of your parents' house, then you do whatever it takes to get that. But that doesn't mean berating yourself, being mean to yourself, stressing yourself out, right? It doesn't mean all of the like painful self-criticism that I think is really what burns people out more than the like writing a bunch of job applications. Right. Mm-hmm. All of the sort of dispiritedness that you're describing comes from believing things should be a certain way, having certain expectations. And then when those don't happen, thinking that means something has gone wrong. Things shouldn't be this way. Right. I mean, this is this very like Buddhist, your suffering is resistance to reality. That's what creates all human suffering. Right. Mm-hmm. Is wanting things to be different than they are.
Yes.
And I think like the work, a lot of what I try to do is articulate a way that we can, from a social justice perspective, but I think it's true in our personal lives too, want things to be different and work towards that without emotionally resisting things being the way they are now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I say that all the time, like get rid of those expectations, but
just
it is
manage
definitely
them.
Manage, that's the word. But Easier said than done, but I'll do my best to work.
But it's
on it.
But it's just back to that thought work practice, right? I mean, yeah. This is none of this is magic. It's like for me, what I reckon, it's like writing down what you're thinking, yeah. And then picking a thought or two that's really painful for you, like I failed or I fucked up or things shouldn't be this way or whatever it is, and then doing like a little baby step thought, like, you know, I mean, I know a coach who did 50 consult calls in a row without closing a single client before she closed one. Like 50 no's in a row.
Yeah.
And wow. Now she's a multiple six-figure business. Like she stuck with it, right? And she kept going and didn't – I mean, not that she had lots of drama along the way. Not that she didn't have mental yeah. drama about it, right? But she kept going and she kept practicing. I think of like action and thought work as like a dialectic. It's like it revolves back and forth. It's not like you have to like have the perfect – thoughts before you can do anything or succeed, right? It's like mm-hmm. change your thinking a little, still get pretty shitty results, but you get a little bit better result. Change your thinking a little bit more, the results get like 5% less shitty, right? It's like, and then you can keep building and moving, right? We're not being perfectionistic about it. Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the reasons that I'm so in love with the work that I teach and the way I learned it from my teacher is that I think that it really breaks down and helps you see like how the results in your life can be wildly different just based on what you're thinking. Like you can take all the action in the world. You can send out 150 applications. If your thought is, I'm never going to get a job, this economy is fucked and there's no way, mm-hmm. you're not going to get a job. And I like the way that it, not because it's magic, but because like the way you phrase the cover letter, the jobs you decide to describe to apply to, the way you show up in the interview emotionally, whether your brain thinks of a creative thing that you could do in that cover letter, or whether your brain is looking for opportunity and remembers that you actually know somebody's third cousin who works at that, like your brain will literally like not see opportunities for problem solving if you believe a problem can't be solved.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It just turns it off. Whereas if you believe a problem can be solved and you are going to succeed, your brain is constantly looking for ways to make that happen. Your brain is like the most powerful computer in the world. And most of us are just like, I just let the monkeys do what they want up there. And then I just hope for the best as opposed to like writing the programming yourself right. to tell your brain what to do.
Yeah.
Totally.
It's not magic. When did you first? Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, wait. Tell me, it's not magic manifesting?
It's not magic. Like when we say like the way you think produces your results, it's not magic manifesting, right? Like if you sit in your apartment and you're like, I just know like my partner, I'm going to find that partner and you don't do anything, like it would have to be the UPS guy. That's not what's going to happen, right? So you're not going to find somebody. But that's not really what happens, because the truth is if you really believe like my partner's out there and I'm excited to find them, you feel optimistic and motivated and committed, and then all your actions are different. Mm-hmm. The person who really believes it's going to happen goes and takes the action to make it happen, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. So when people are like, oh, if you believe it'll happen, it's like it's not like you called upon the fairies. It's like when you believe a certain way, then you feel a certain way, then you act a certain way, and your actions are what get you to that result that you want. So it's like the mechanism behind what people call like positive thinking or manifestation or whatever.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you, when in your life did you kind of like come to this consciousness of I can change my life myself?
Well, I think more like a slow boil and then finding the right ingredients. So I was always interested I've been a professional feminist kind of my whole life. I was in the reproductive rights movement. I was a reproductive rights lawyer, and then I was an academic before I quit to become a life coach, as one does. But I was always interested in psychology and coaching and therapy. You know, I was the 16-year-old who was like, I'm going to therapy. You need to drive me and pay for it. Like, I was always interested in
That's like genius, though. How did you become like that? Are your parents really liberal in that way?
Well, they're really liberal. They definitely were not like, we're all going to therapy. They were not anti, yeah. But, you know, I mean, I was like, I'm going, you need to take care of it. And they were like, okay. I don't know. I mean, I do think, I don't know. You know, some of this stuff does seem like if not genetic, very innate in terms of just like what are our very early interests. Like, you know, some people like at three, you're like, I need to play the piano. I know how, right? And everybody's like, how do you know what you just do, right? And some people at three are like, I got to play soccer. And I don't know. So I do think I've always been you know, I read a lot growing up. My father's a rare book dealer. We didn't have a TV. He had a very aggressive reading program that I was put through. So I think that I like, which, you know, I complained about a lot as a child. But I do think that reading a lot of, number one, reading a lot of fiction, I think it very early gets you interested in, like, you're very early conscious of other people's interiority. Like, other people have minds that think a different way. People think different ways about things. People are having very different experiences, but also what is common about the human experience. So I just think I have always been very, my like overriding intellectual preoccupation ever since I was little has just been like, what is being a human? Like, what is this experience we're having? How do we communicate it to each other? How do we bridge the fact that, like, we can never actually be inside each other's heads? So we think we're all describing the same thing, but, like, are we describing the same thing? What is the good life? Like, how do we decide how to live? Like, all of that. You know, I'd like to think that was all, like, new and intriguing to me, but, like, I found my high school yearbook when I was moving, and like my high school yearbook quotes are just totally all about this. This is just the only thing I've ever actually cared to think about. But I just took a long detour into constitutional litigation. So anyway, I've been like going to therapy, I was into yoga, I was into meditation, but a lot like you, you know, a lot of people come to this work. It's like a bait and switch. We're like, oh, do you need to fix yourself? Come in, I'll teach you how. And then you get in, we're like, just kidding. You don't need to fix yourself. There's nothing wrong with you. But like, that's how I got there too, for sure. You know, I was like, definitely like, that was the positive side is what I just told you. But there was also the negative side of like, terrible body image and thinking I wasn't good enough and thinking I was unworthy and thinking I was unlovable, and like maybe yoga was going to fix it, meditation was going to fix it, therapy was going to fix it, coaching was going to fix it. You know, I had tried all the different things. But then I found my teacher, whose name is Brooke Castillo of the Life Coach School, hilariously in the last like weight loss coaching thing I did before I discovered the idea of like diet culture and health at any size and body positivity. That's where I met her, my teacher. And it was like she was teaching weight loss, but then teaching all this amazing thought work. And I was like, but I could just do the thought work. Like if I just, you know, the way she taught it and the way that school teaches, which is why I am affiliated with it anyway, right, is like you have to love yourself. Like weight loss, losing weight is not going to change what you think and feel about yourself. And in fact, you can't do it from being self-punishing. And you have, you know, so like I was like, but wait, if I'm going to change my thoughts to love myself, then like, good goal accomplished. Like, I don't need this other stuff, you know? And at the same time, I was learning more about, you know, what I believe to be the correct science about, you know, how common it is to be able to intentionally lose weight and keep it off, what impacts weight, what are, you know, health at any size movement, the misconceptions in the kind of mainstream medical community who don't learn anything about weight and metabolics and nutrition. So that was just a very formative period of like learning those things in quick succession. I sort of put them together and was like, oh, wait, I think that I can like use this thought work not only to love myself, but rather than then use it to like try to change my behavior and force a temporary weight loss, I can use it to change all my thoughts about like why I want to be thin and why people should be thin and what is attractive and all of that. So that was really like, I think my body image work was like the crucible for it. And I did that work. And then that was so transformative that I started applying it to other areas of my life. And you know, 8 years later, there you go. You've quit your job at Columbia Law School and you are a life coach on the internet. That's what happened.
That is so cool. Kara, thank you so much for coming on Dating Straight. I'm a big fan. So if people want to hear more about thought work, where can they find you?
Thank you for having me. I also think it's hilarious. We barely talked about dating at all. You can find me at my podcast.
That's so true. We like never talk.
You're like, this dating. Just a, we just bring you in that way. And then we teach you, then we teach you the philosophy. My podcast is called Unfuck Your Brain. You can find it anywhere you find podcasts or at unfuckyourbrain.com.
Thanks for listening. I'm Amy Oddman.
I'm Jack Dodge and this is Dating Straight.
See you next Tuesday. We could be broken-hearted lovers. You can help me recover.